Good evening, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Welcome to tonight's program. It's about 7 past the hour. How you doing? You okay? I'm still dealing with a hacking cough. sorry about that, but what is. This hour is sponsored by Anonymous. Is this a different Anonymous? Oh, okay. A different Anonymous. Gotcha. The message from a different Anonymous is to all the conservatives, Tea Partiers, Libertarians, and other right-wing affiliated people listening, evolve already. Those of us who have are tired of waiting for you miserable people to catch up. All right, Anonymous. Evolve already. Yeah. The Republicans were out in full force over the past couple of days. I watched a little bit of Mitt Romney offer up his jobs program. I didn't know that Romney couldn't put a sentence together. That was pretty bad. When you take a look at these people, you know who the most articulate of the group is? I mean, she's a total psychopath and a liar, but the most articulate of the group is Michelle Bachmann. And when people can string sentences together with subject, verb, object, you know, the great unwashed will listen to that and go, yeah, she still sure does talk good. I'm gonna vote for her. She talks good. That's a good talker there. Speaking of talkers, Chomsky has a piece out right now about, in a retrospective, looking back on 9/11 a decade later. Awful lot of stuff is out there right now. I shared something with you the other night, Jesse Richards at TVNewsLies.org. A lot of stuff is out there about 9/11. And it's building to a crescendo. What's the date? Is this the 6th, Cassie? The 6th, the 7th? What date is today? 6th? So, 5 days. And I think the thing that we all need to remember is whose watch it occurred on. Since there's going to be no accountability, the Bush crime family is not going to be held responsible for what they did or didn't do. That really doesn't matter. The end result is all that matters. In a situation like what happened in this country on September 11th, 2001. The Bush crime family, led by one of the most criminal minds in American political history, Dick Cheney, they were in control. Let's keep that foremost in our recollections of what occurred September 11th, 2001. Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld were in control. To whatever degree they did, they engineered this, either let it happen, made it happen, ignored all the warnings. It doesn't make any difference to me. I don't even want to talk about that tonight. The truth of 9/11, as Jesse Richards said, you don't know the truth of 9/11 because you don't know the truth of 9/11 or something like that. But it made perfect sense the other night when I read it to you. But George W. Bush, who took this country with the invasion of Iraq using the incident of September 11, 2001, as his, the Polish are coming, which is what Hitler did. What George W. Bush did, Cheney, I should say Cheney Bush. Bush was a murderous little twerp, but he was, you know, he wasn't in the professional leagues at all. He was pure amateurism. And as Chomsky says, it might be instructive to ask ourselves how we would be reacting if Iraqi commandos had landed at George W. Bush's compound, assassinated him, and dumped his body in the Atlantic after proper burial rites, of course. He's referring, of course, to the attack on and the murder of bin Laden. Uncontroversially, he was not a suspect, but he was the decider who gave the orders to invade Iraq. That is, to commit, quote, the supreme international crime differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole, end quote. Now, that's a direct quote from the Nuremberg War Trials. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, Chief Counsel for the United States at Nuremberg. Nazi criminals were hanged because of that. But George W. Bush was the decider who gave the orders to invade Iraq, with the subsequent hundreds of thousands of deaths, millions of refugees, destruction of much of the country and its national heritage, and the murderous sectarian conflict that has now spread to the rest of the region. Equally uncontroversially. There's no controversy about this. We just don't. Nobody talks about this in the United States of America. Not the media. Not the political class. Nobody. Oh, except here on this little 25-cent radio program. Equally uncontroversially, these crimes vastly exceed anything attributed to bin Laden. What George W. Bush did makes bin Laden look like a punk, like a street coke dealer or something. Bush and Cheney, world class criminals. To say that all of this, Chomsky writes, is uncontroversial, as it is not to imply that it's not denied. The existence of flat earthers does not change the fact that, uncontroversially, the earth is not flat. Similarly, Chomsky says, it is uncontroversial that Stalin and Hitler were responsible for horrendous crimes, though their loyalists deny it. All of this should, again, be too obvious for comment and would be except in an atmosphere of hysteria so extreme that it blocks rational thought. Similarly, it is uncontroversial that Bush and associates, Chomsky says, I say Cheney, did commit the supreme international crime, the crime of aggression, the crime that was defined clearly enough by Justice Robert Jackson, Chief Counsel of the United States at Nuremberg. An aggressor, Jackson proposed to the tribunal in his opening statement, an aggressor is a state that is the first to commit such actions as the invasion of its armed forces with or without a declaration of war of the territory of another state. End quote. Justice Robert Jackson. No one, even the most extreme supporter of what Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld did, denies that Bush and associates did just that. They committed the supreme crime. What Nuremberg decided differed only from other war crimes in that this kind of aggression contained within itself the accumulated evil of everything for which the Nazi criminals were hanged. Everything started with that invasion, those invasions, those attacks against other countries. Exactly what George Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld did. Now, who's holding them accountable? Right. Now, there's just a little bit more here. And I'll share it with you when we come back. But I bring this up because with all the talk about 9/11. You know, all this focus. You know, this was, as Chomsky points out, this was the second 9/11. The first 9/11 was what the United States perpetrated against Chile in 1972 with the assassination. Oh, we'll talk about that when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malone of Salvador Allende, and you know, we'll be right back.
Seekers, Uncle Mikey has another bedtime story. Back to Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. So, your good friend Noam Chomsky, looking back on 9/11 a decade later, and he makes a very salient point that one of the consequences of 9/11, and remember, the Project for New American Century tried to prevail upon Bill Clinton back in 98 to invade Iraq. Clinton said no. But one of the consequences, or one of the sidebars, or the consequential plots, was the invasion of Iraq. There are reports that say, immediately after the attack on this country by somebody on September 11th, Rumsfeld was heard to say, let's go for everything, let's sweep it all up. Meaning, the invasion of Iraq, among other places. So, and in doing so, the Cheney-Bush-Rumsfeld triumvirate turned the United States into an outlaw, criminal, aggressor. By our definition. Not by somebody else's. Not by some Supreme Court. Not by some state legislature. Not by the Chi-Coms. But by the definition that we use to hang people after World War II. As a result of the Nuremberg war trials, war crimes trials. Where it was firmly established that what Cheney, and this son of a bitch is now wandering around the electronic landscape. And there's not an anchor in America who won't call the rat bastard what he is. Mr. Cheney, how do you feel about being a war criminal? How do you feel about the hundreds of thousands of deaths that you ordered, you goddamn ghoul? Nobody will do that. Ah, Mr. Cheney, well, do you have any regrets about the decisions you made? Well, Mr. Cheney, what about those reports, you know, that there were no weapons of mass destruction? You guys knew it before you invaded. What about that? All lies. Oh, okay. Let's move on. That's what this killer and the twit, the dumbass Bush, this is the kind of reception that they're getting. Cheney, Bush, Rumsfeld turned the United States by our rules, our definitions, into a murderous, rogue, out of control, aggressor state. And now these people, whoever they are, have the audacity to say that Muslims are reacting badly to what Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld took us into? Wow. Chomsky says, we also might do well to recall Jackson's eloquent words at Nuremberg on the principle of universality. Quote, if certain acts in violation of treaties are crimes, they are crimes whether the United States does them or whether Germany does them. And we are not prepared to lay down a rule of criminal conduct against others, which we would not be willing to have invoked against us. End quote. Oh, really? Well, what the hell, that was 60-some years ago. You know, different time, different place, different result being sought. But listen to those words. If certain acts in violation of treaties are crimes, they're crimes whether the U.S. does them or whether Germany does them. And we're not prepared to lay down a rule of criminal conduct against others, which we would not be willing to have invoked against us. Mr. Justice Jackson, you never knew Dick Cheney. You never knew George W. Bush. You never knew Don Rumsfeld. You never knew John Yoo. You never knew Roberto Gonzalez. You never knew Condoleezza Rice. You never knew Colin Powell. So, and there's a couple more here, a couple more paragraphs when we come back after this break. But I just wish that there would be some discussion somewhere on earth. Well, somewhere in this country. A discussion about the violent, horrific acts created, committed by the United States in violation of our own invocations against the Germans. We hanged them. We executed them. For the very things that Cheney, Bush, Rumsfeld, and the rest of this tribe of monstrous, murderous sons of bitches who happen to be Americans committed against the people of Iraq as a result of what happened in this country on September 11, 2001. But it's inconsequential, isn't it? We don't care. Now, by we, I'm not talking about you and me. Of course we care. But you and I don't care what they say in the self-help books. You and I are utterly, absolutely, completely powerless where it concerns this issue.
And I decide what is best, and what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
Sitting in a White House garden, talking to the Lord. But my thoughts would be busy, busy hatching if I only had a brain. I am the egghead. I'm the commander.
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. This hour is sponsored by Anonymous. A different Anonymous. Apparently we have a couple of Anonymi. This is Anonymous, whose message is to all the conservatives, Tea Partiers, Libertarians, or other right-wing affiliated people listening, evolve already. Those of us who have, are tired of waiting for you miserable people to catch up. Thanks, Anonymous. So Chomsky is laying out some hard truths like Chomsky always does. That's why he can't really get a hearing in this country in mass media. They are terrified of him because he sees right through their BS. And but Chomsky has written kind of a retrospective on September 11th, a decade later here. And he points out a fact that nobody else in the United States cares to point out, and that is, according to our own decisions at Nuremberg, the Bush-Cheney crime family committed the supreme international crime. Supreme international crime. And as Justice Jackson said at the time, that crime differs only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole, of everything. The invasion. And of course, in the case of Cheney and Bush and Rumsfeld and the rest of these murderers, the unprovoked invasion based on lies, the same as Hitler saying that the Poles were attacking across the border. The Poles, who didn't even have a tank corps. The Poles who resisted on horseback to the panzer divisions that blew across their border, right? So, we, the United States, the victors in World War II, tried to make it very clear. And as Justice Jackson said, if certain acts in violation of treaties are crimes, they are crimes whether the United States does them or whether Germany does them. And we are not prepared to lay down a rule of criminal conduct against others, which we would not be willing to have invoked against us, end quote. Now, consider that when you consider what Cheney and Bush and you and Gonzalez and the rest of these murderous, traitorous sons of bitches, their rationale, if that's the proper word, for torture. Well, what happens if our people now are captured and tortured, you criminal bastards? Oh, they don't care about that? Eh. If our people are captured and tortured, the torturers, if found, caught, will be subject to the full force of America's might. It is also clear, Chomsky writes, that announced intentions are irrelevant, even if they are truly believed. Internal records, for example, reveal that Japanese fascists apparently did believe that by ravaging China, they were laboring to turn it into, quote, an earthly paradise, end quote. And although it may be difficult to imagine, it is conceivable that Bush and company believed they were protecting the world from destruction by Saddam's nuclear weapons. But all that is irrelevant. Although ardent loyalists on all sides may try to convince themselves otherwise, we are left with two choices. Now listen to this. Listen. Two choices. Either Bush and associates are guilty of the supreme international crime, including all the evils that follow, or else we declare that the Nuremberg proceedings were a farce and the Allies were guilty of judicial murder. There's no third way. So, there's more to this essay that Chomsky wrote, and I think you should find it and read it. I really do. Looking Back on 9/11 a Decade Later by Noam Chomsky. So here we are, and in less than a week, we will be forced once again to listen to the myth-making regarding what occurred in this country on September 11, 2001. I am not talking about the genuine suffering of the families of the people who died, whether they were office workers, investment bankers, first responders. Their deaths were brutal, violent. Their families and loved ones will suffer with it forever. For as long as their family and friends draw breath, they'll suffer with it. But the stink of Cheney and Bush and the Bush crime family hangs over this country like a pall. It does to me. Everything that represents the rancid smell of a decaying society, of a vicious, murderous military machine, everything that is represented by this evil hangs over this country 24/7. We can't get away from it. So we choose to ignore it or pretend like we ignore it. The slaughter goes on. It will continue to go on. And nobody in this country in the political establishment has the decency or the respect for law. When I hear these teabaggers talk about the Constitution, I like to grab a copy of it and just beat them with it. You sons of bitches have no more respect for the Constitution than you do for your own selves. You are pigs, all of you, every single one of you. And the Democrats, you cowardly bastards, you allowed this country to be run by war criminals? You allowed this to happen? You said impeachment is off the table? You rancid, cowardly sons of bitches, a president was impeached for lying about oral sex with his girlfriend, and you allowed that to happen. But a mass killing machine that invaded another country and committed the ultimate crime as defined by us 60 years ago, and you sat on your asses, Pelosi and the rest of you cowards, and said it's off the table. Every single one of you are guilty, guilty, guilty of crimes of the same nature as those committed by the Nazis that we hanged. God. So, you know, as we approach this season of commemoration of what occurred 10 years ago, is it at all possible? I know it's not. Just here, just in this little corner over here, this little tiny program. I don't know. Maybe there's somebody else. I don't know. I have no idea. I don't listen to the radio anymore unless it's NPR. So I don't know what so-called liberal or progressive talk show hosts are talking about. I have no idea. I get reports that all they're talking about is, well, you got to vote for Obama or the Supreme Court is lost. And the Cheney cabal could be brought up on war crimes violations even now. Even now. I mean, Barack Obama could appoint a special prosecutor, couldn't he? I think he could. Eric Holder could, couldn't he? Huh? I think he could. Is it going to happen? Hell no. So what does that make Obama? An accessory after the fact. Mr. Obama, you're just as guilty. You're just as guilty because you were sitting there doing nothing. Nothing. You are trying to work with the war criminals. And Bill Clinton, you disgusting, bloated son of a bitch, the way you hang out with George W. Bush. The way the two of you act like that crazed old woman that spawned the Bush brothers is your mama too. Clinton, you are disgusting. These people tried to cut your guts out. And does Bill Clinton call for a war crimes tribunal in the United States regarding these people? No. What does Clinton do?
Yeah, well, you know, George and I went, his dad and I, we're trying to save the people in Haiti, you know. There's a lot of trouble down there. They had a tornado. They had an earthquake, really. And I'll tell you what, here's what you got to do.
Somewhere I can even spell the name of. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I want a big, big Mac and double fries. I want to wave my American standards high. I want to fly my flag across your sky. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Anonymous, whose message is to all the conservatives, Tea Partiers, libertarians, or other right-wing affiliated people listening, evolve already. Those of us who have are tired of waiting for you miserable people to catch up. Oh, amen, amen, amen. Thanks, Anonymous. The events of September 11th, 2001, of course, changed us as a nation. We'll never be what we were before. And whether you see that as good, bad, or indifferent is really immaterial. It was a defining moment. There was pre-9/11, there's post-9/11. Now, you would think then, wouldn't you? At least I do. That if we have a moment in our history that is so definitive, that is so much of a separation between before and after, that if it were an act of criminality, that the perpetrators would be tracked down. And if it were some massive, wondrous moment of enlightenment, that we would be celebrating it forever. So what do we have here? We have an event that occurred on the watch of a criminal organization, the Bush-Cheney Crime Organization, whose sole intent in stealing that election in 2000 was to move into a position where they could do the damage that they did, where they could assist the capitalists in this country of finally slamming the window on anything that even remotely resembled representative government. So they did their job. But they had to have that precipitating event. They had to have something that would put into play the USA Patriot Act, the invasion of countries that they wanted to invade. They had to have something. Well, several years before, people who wound up dictating the direction and the policies of the Bush crime family, including Cheney, put out a statement that suggested what the United States needed was another Pearl Harbor. And also suggesting that an attack against Iraq would make perfect sense. In other words, every single person who signed off on the PNAC statement, the Project for New American Century statement, is guilty of a war crime. A war crime defined by Justice Jackson as being the supreme war crime. One so vile, so horrific, that it contained within it every other crime to follow. And that is the invasion, the attack against another country. And in the case of all these people, Wolfowitz and go down the list. You know who they are. Ari Fleischer, Cheney, Bush, all of them. Every single person who is involved is guilty of the kind of war crime for which we hanged the German members of the German High Command. We hanged them. And what happens in this country? Nothing. They write books. They go back to teaching. They go to work for capitalist think tanks or the murder industry. And nothing happens. Nothing. So where does that leave us? You know, you and me. Where does that leave us? Well, since we are sentient beings, since we are coherent, since we do think occasionally, it leaves us as complicit in all this. How can we not be? because we know what happened. We know what happened. I'm not talking about the particulars of 9/11. I'm talking about the particulars of the Bush-Cheney crime family. What they did using the events of 9/11 as their justification for any goddamn crime that they wanted to commit against us, against them, against those people over there, that country over there, this war on terror, everything, everything flowed from the lie of 9/11. So what do we do now? Nothing. Right? What is there to do? What is there to do? The people that have the power say nothing. Everybody seems to be pretending that, you know, nothing untoward has happened. Oh, yeah, bunch of terrorists attacked us, and we sought revenge, and, you know, we got the son of a bitch who organized it. Do you ever wonder why the United States government has never, ever, ever, ever produced even a shred of evidence that shows that Osama bin Laden was the one who organized this, the attack on September 11th. Don't you ever wonder why? It's just like those 80 cameras that were trained on the Pentagon, and yet not a single photograph ever, not a single bit of video ever has been released showing a commercial jetliner slamming into the side of the Pentagon. Don't you ever even think about that? Wonder about it? Or are we all, you know, good Americans? We just keep our heads down, stare at the cracks in the sidewalk, and go about our business. And what's our business now? Trying to find a job. Trying to figure out how in the hell we're going to get the kids in school. Trying to figure out how in the hell we're going to pay for our spouse's desperately needed operation. Jesus God. The hour. This is the Malloy program. This hour is sponsored by Francis Leckie. Thank you, Francis. No message, just a sponsorship, and we appreciate it. Thank you very much, Francis. This was just posted at Washington Post website about 2 hours ago. Felicia Sanmez, who writes a blog there called Two Chambers. The chairwoman of the Senate Intelligence Committee said today that she would oppose any move by the Obama administration to draw down troops in Iraq to 3,000 by the end of the year. See what I mean? Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, made the remarks to reporters at the Capitol hours after Fox News reported that Defense Secretary Leon Panetta had already signed off on the number, according to multiple sources familiar with the inner workings and decisions on U.S. troop movements. Panetta maintained Tuesday that, quote, no decision has been made, end quote, on the troop levels. Feinstein told reporters, I think it's a mistake. I think we now see groups attacking and dozens of people being killed in each attack, and I think the situation needs to be secured, and it isn't right now. You see? You see what we did? I wonder if Feinstein ever reads Chomsky. So all the warmongers, oh, you know this, are not in the Republican Party. There are about 46,000 U.S. troops still stationed in Iraq, and most of those have been on track to withdraw by the end of this year. And in June, 15 U.S. soldiers were killed in Iraq. You don't hear anything about Iraq anymore, do you? Huh? Except the bombings, the terror attacks on each other, the factional fighting, Sunnis against Shia, this group against that group vying for power in the power vacuum that we created. It's just the gift that keeps on giving, right? Huh? John McCain, Joe Lieberman, and Lindsey Graham, the three tenors, said they were deeply troubled by the report that we're going to pull out down to 3,000 troops. They issued a statement. This is dramatically lower than what our military leaders have consistently told us over the course of repeated visits to Iraq that they require and that is needed to support Iraq in safeguarding the hard-won gains that our two nations, have achieved at such great cost. In particular, we are very concerned by the prospect that a follow-on force might lack the capabilities and authorities necessary to help Iraqis ensure stability across the disputed territories in northern Iraq, which we consider an essential mission. We urge the administration to work urgently with Iraqi authorities to reach an agreement that reflects the best military advice. I guess I can't be a tenor. Military advice of U.S. commanders on the ground and allows the U.S. to safeguard our national interest in Iraq's stability. Our national interest. Our national interest. Son of a bitch. And some of you folks do wonder why I say if you vote Democrat, you're a goddamn fool. But go ahead, because I know you will. I know you're going to vote Democrat anyway, because you know, well, Mike, the Supreme Court! Holy Christ! Right? Dianne Feinstein, huh? Okay, remember the other day, Monday, I think, James Hoffa Jr., Teamsters president, yeah, the son, was warming up the crowd for President Obama in Detroit the other day, and he said the following, quote, "We got to keep an eye on the battle that we face, the war on workers. And you see it everywhere. It is the Tea Party. And you know, there's only one way to beat and win that war. The one thing about working people is we like a good fight. And you know what? They got a war. They got a war with us. And there's going to be one winner. It's going to be the workers of Michigan and America. We're going to win that war. President Obama, this is your army out here. We're ready to march. Let's take these sons of bitches out and give America back to an America where we belong." And, of course, the crowd went crazy with applause. And then Obama addressed the crowd right after that. Well, Mr. Pig Feces responded. The huge, enormous troll that has the noon to three program across the fruited plain, coast to coast, border to border. Rush, Pig Feces, Limbaugh. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen. He responded today. He said regarding what Hoffa said, "That's a call for violence. It's a call for violence, folks. From Don Hoffa to Barack Obama, standing right beside him. Can there be any doubt?
that Hoffa, maybe along with Obama, thinking Republicans are their bitches ever since he was elected? Ladies and gentlemen, Hoffa was not speaking metaphorically. No, no, he wasn't. No, he wasn't. This is not about targets on some online map. You know, we do that and doesn't mean anything. This was not talk about reloading. This was a direct call for violence. Make no mistake about this. It was a direct call for violence. A direct threat against a large portion of the American people.
Please, Rush, please have a stroke. Please have a stroke. A massive, great, big, popping sound that'll be heard border to border and coast to coast across the fruited plain. Kabam! What was that? That was an artery in Rush's head. Oh, really? Really? Can you replay that? Sure. Kabam! Man! Some of that get on you? Oh, yeah, Christ, it was all over the place, you know. I mean, there was spurts of red going all the way up to Michigan. One more time. Okay. Kabam! Wow. That's a big noise. Well, he had it was a big aneurysm. Really? God damn. I don't know. What else we got? Oh, yeah. This is from the National Jewish Democratic Council online, njdc.org, I think it is. Republican presidential candidate Texas Governor Rick Perry is currently reading Charles Stanley's Turning the Tide, a book that may be of great interest to American Jews and others. Excerpts from the book include the exhortations to, quote, pray that Jews worldwide will accept him, capital H, Jesus, as their savior, and to pray for God's protection against terrorism, and that's that Muslims through the world will come to know Jesus as their savior. Politico described it as a Baptist pastor's how-to for Christian conservatives who want to change the country's direction. According to New York Magazine's Joe Coscarelli, quote, some choice excerpts from the actual words inside this book reveal change the country's direction to be something for a euphemism for convert all Jews because they are heathens. That's Rick Perry. Isn't religion fun? Ah, don't you just love religion, right? Oh, my goodness sakes. Rick Perry. Oh, Charles Stanley. He's from right here in Atlanta. I got into a spitting contest with that bastard one time about, oh my God, 20 years ago. I still hate you, Reverend Charles. You're still a punk.
Why don't you come on back to the war? Let's all get nervous. You cannot stand what I've become. You much prefer the gentleman I was before. I was so easy to defeat, I was so easy to control, I didn't even know there was a war. Why don't you...
Cleaning up America one flying monkey at a time, here's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. So anyway, Rick Perry is working on this, convert the Jews and the Muslims, especially the Jews. The Muslims, they just want to kill the Muslims. Got to finish that job started by Richard the Lionhearted, I guess. But the New Yorker's Ryan Lizza tweeted some additional excerpts from Charles Stanley's book, including, quote, pray that Jews worldwide will accept him as a savior. May the people of Israel acknowledge their guilt, seek your face, and accept your son, the Messiah. And then, of course, there's the claim, common on the religious right, that our founding fathers, and Stanley goes on, quote, based the Constitution and the laws of our country on the principles they found in Scripture, and that leaders should reaffirm our Christian heritage and reestablish your biblical precepts. Who do you write this to? God?
He wrote this to God. Hey, God, read my book. Give me a good review, okay? Perry has echoed these teachings in his own assertion that natural law, that is, God's law, is the basis of our nation's laws. Huh? And so far, he's been more quiet about his Muslim and Jew saving. That's from the National Jewish Democratic Council, NJDC.org online. You can check it out. Yeah, Charles Stanley he's the one that it never came out. He divorced his wife. Remember that? That was about 15 years ago. Got a divorce from his wife. I guess she just couldn't stand the scarring and the scourging every night. You know, maybe that was it. But I got into it with him one time on... what was that show CNN used to do from the atrium down there? Talk Back Live, yeah. A friend of ours was the producer of that show. And I got invited there very frequently, as a matter of fact. Had a great time. And Charles Stanley, I don't know why they would invite him, but they would. And I just had a nasty confrontation with his hypocritical horse crap, you know, his pseudo Christianity. I don't know what the hell he preaches, but it's damn sure not the word of Jesus. It's not anything even in the same country as the Sermon on the Mount. It has nothing whatsoever to do with that. Oh well. You wonder why gasoline prices keep going high? You've been wondering? Up we go again, right? Do you want to know why? The nation's refineries are continuing to boost exports and reduce supplies available in the United States. Now, you need to know this because Obama is about to sign off on the tar sands horror from Alberta to Texas to, I told you the other night, to a export zone where there are no taxes. And the way it's being pitched by Obama and everybody else is, you know, energy independence, right? You know, we're going to stop getting it from foreign sources. What the hell is Canada? It's not the 51st state. Oh, my God. In California, the average price of a gallon regular jumped 12 cents just last week. The average price is now around $3.94 a gallon. That's 89 cents a gallon higher than the price a year ago. Tom Kloza, chief oil analyst for the Oil Price Information Service in New Jersey, said, quote, the U.S. petroleum balance of trade continues to shift in a sea change that is both literal and figurative. For the 10th week in a row, Energy Department numbers show that the country exported considerably more refined products, cargoes, than were imported. you want to get us off of foreign oil? Then stop selling ours! No, that's too simple. Five years ago, U.S. imports outpaced exports by about 3 million barrels a day. 2 years ago, fuel imports still outpaced exports by 1.5 million barrels a day. The most recent statistics show exports from the U.S. outpacing imports by 500,000 barrels a day. We are now a net exporter of refined petroleum products, gasoline being at the very top. We are exporting it. Was this a screaming headline on today's New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC? Any place? Huh? Anybody? And you want to know why the price is going up? Well, because the oil companies get more if they sell it overseas. For Christ's sake, that's not hard to figure out. Oh, well, we've got to have energy independence, right? We gotta free ourselves from foreign oil.
Who says that? They all say that, don't they? I think Obama said it, well, yesterday, and the Republicans say it all the time. Nobody tells the truth anymore, do they?
Screaming with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. This hour sponsored by Francis Leckie. Thank you, Francis. Mucho thanks. Now, why would Feinstein be saying what she's saying about, oh, no. Draw down American troops? No. Is she really concerned about the poor Iraqis? Is she really concerned about Iraq as a threat to the national security of the United States, or could it be something else? Well, from the Chronicle, 2003, now the date's important, 8 years ago. Her husband, of course, you probably know this, her husband, Richard Blum, is one of the directors and controls 24% of the stock of a company called URS Corporation. And back in 2003, they landed an Army contract worth up to $600 million. And the award is to help with troop mobilization, weapon systems training, anti-terrorism efforts, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And it says here, it's the latest in a string of plum defense jobs snared by URS. In February, the firm won an Army engineering and logistics contract that could bring in $3.1 billion during the next 8 years. 8 years. Let's see, 8 years from 2003. My goodness, that's 2011. Let me look at the calendar here. Well, that's now. Huh. 24% of the stock controlled by Dianne Feinstein's husband, Richard Blum. And the 8 years is up, right, Rich? Huh? In February 2003, the firm won an Army engineering and logistics contract, whatever that means, that could bring in $3.1 billion during the next 8 years. The 8 years is up, Richard. Get your old lady to start whining and bitching and calling and clawing about, oh no, we don't want no troop drawdown. We want more death. More American soldiers die. God damn it, my husband's only made $2 or $3 billion. Every single one of them. These members of Congress. These multimillionaires. Who sit there like, I don't know, like poisonous toads. And continue to direct foreign policy in a manner that enriches them at the expense of how many lives? Americans, Iraqis, Yemenis, I don't know who, Somalis, Israelis, Palestinians. It doesn't matter. It doesn't make a goddamn bit of difference. Nothing. Give me the money! Dianne Feinstein. So apparently Richard Blum took a sharp stick and rammed it up his something, and motivated his senator wife to go out there today and start screaming and screeching about Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta. How does that sound? Ooh-hoo. How does this sound? Director of the CIA, David Petraeus. Yeah?
Doesn't that make you confused? Leo Panetta. So anyway, Richard Bloom apparently gets a sharp stick and motivates his wife to screech about what Panetta is denying, but other people in the defense murder establishment are confirming that, yeah, the plan was to reduce the 46,000 American troops down to 3,000 by the end of this year. When did we invade? When did we commit the worst war crime possible, according to the Nuremberg trials? When did we commit that war crime? The crime of such monumental proportions that it includes all other crimes that may result as, that may come as a result of an invasion and occupation of another country? When was that? 2003, wasn't it? Shock and awe. When was that, Kathy? March 2003? April 2000? Somewhere around there? So the contract is run out, right, Richard Blum? Right? Mr. Dianne Feinstein's husband? Huh? Contract's up? $3.1 billion? Not enough? How much did you skim off, you rancid son of a bitch? I know you skimmed as much as you could get your hands on. You're no different from the rest of them. You're no different from Cheney. Cheney does the same thing through his companies. Man, it just never stops, does it? So what do you think of your Democratic senator from California, all you Democrats out there, huh? Do you think there's any connection? Huh? You think? No, think about it. Seriously, think about it. You think there's any connection between these two facts? Fact one, the national security state, that is the United States, has made a decision somewhere up and down the chain of command that starts in the corporatist boardrooms and works its way down to the president. A decision was made to get the troops out of there. Who knows? Who knows why? All right, we've had our fun and games. Time to pull out. We've got the oil contracts. Get those good hero American boys out of there, right? They've been heroes for 8 years now. Multiple deployments over and over and over again. We've destroyed American families and Iraqi families. We've caused murders and suicides. We got thousands upon thousands of American soldiers now on drugs because of PTSD. Let's bring these poor, broken sons of bitches home. We've had our fun. We had our second Pearl Harbor. You like that? Time to come home. Don't know why. Well, I do know why. We got to get ready to invade and attack Iran. So let's get the boys home. We'll leave the 100,000 over there in Afghanistan, but let's get these poor miserable sons of bitches out of Iraq. Okay? Okay. And out of the weeds comes Dianne Feinstein screaming and frothing at the mouth. Oh no. Oh no, you don't. Oh no, you don't. You're not taking away our means of support. So who cares about this stuff, huh? Anybody? The Washington Post reported on Feinstein's screaming and cawing about... got to leave the troops there for national security. But I didn't see anything in the article about the fact that her husband is a war contractor. And I wouldn't have had that in my hands except Reg over at TVNewsLies.org sent it to me. Bada-bing, bada-boom. There it is. It's 8 years old. Who knows from this stuff, right? Who knows from this stuff? Do you think any of the... liberal or progressive talk show hosts will hop on their radio waves tomorrow morning and say, hey, guess what? Dianne Feinstein is saying, no, no, keep the troops there. No, 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 no. 8 years is not enough. Oh, and by the way, her husband is a huge, massive weapons contractor. Huh? Probably not. Hmm.
Yeah, there's a way out of all this. There is. You know, I've talked about it several times. It's like a junkie. It really is. It's like being the worst kind of an addict. You know, you got sores up and down your arms. You got gangrene starting to set in. You're down to about 85 pounds. You don't eat anymore. Why eat? You know, you gotta have that smack. Gotta have that hit. You gotta have it. You gotta have that needle. Your veins are all collapsing. What are you gonna do? Oh my God. Well, between your toes. No, done that. That vein along the side of your temple and done that. My arms are rotting and decaying. But I just can't get off of my heroin. Yeah, what kind of heroin you do? War. Capitalism. Invasions. I just can't stop. Democratic Party. I can't stop. Democratic Party. That's the worst drug you could take. You know why? Yeah, I know why. It makes me feel good for a minute and then just smashes me against the floor. Yeah, I know why. Why don't you switch to Republican drug? Oh, I tried that. Oh, my God. That gave me diarrhea for months. Puking all the time. Well, listen, you got to break your drug addiction. You've got to get away from the Democratic Party. It's killing you. Do you not understand this? It's killing you. Can't you get into rehab? Can't you? I mean, can you see a shrink? Can you try? I don't know. Can you switch to the Green Party? Maybe that'd be like methadone for you. You got to break your addiction. If you don't, you're going to kill yourself.
Are they going to die? Gasoline's in short supply. ExxonMobil is barely getting by. With millions in profits, it's just another lie. Hey, don't it make you red state? Hey, don't it make you red state? Hey, don't it make you red state blue?
You are now entering a flying monkey free zone. It's Mike Malone.
Ten before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Francis Leckie. Thank you so much, Francis. We do appreciate it. Next hour, we are going to talk about, or I'm going to talk about, it's only one of me here doing the talking. I am going to talk about the end of the Postal Service as we know it. It's coming. It is coming. I don't know if you have seen the press about this. But we'll talk about it. Paul Krugman the other day in the Times under the heading Fatal Distraction. Whoever comes up with these headlines for Krugman is usually pretty good. Ever since the beginning of this horror, economic collapse, he's been trying to focus his column on what to do about it, how to move ahead, especially where it concerns stimulus for the economy. He's really taken Obama to task many times, as you know, because you read Paul Krugman. He's taken Obama to task because of Obama's half measures, because of the cowardly nonsense that Obama tries to pass off as economic stimulus. And it may not be cowardly nonsense. It may be just doing what he is instructed to do. And the budget cutting. You know, these Republican horrors, all of them, whether they're running for president or not. You know, don't forget what Mitch McConnell said at the start of the session of Congress. Our singular objective is to make sure that Obama's a one-term president. They have done nothing except that since then. The country can go to hell. Every one of these sons of bitches are guilty of treason. Treason, in the definable sense, treason. They are traitors to their country, every single one of them, starting with that mush-mouth little bastard, Mitch McConnell, and working all the way through the Republican Party in the Senate and in the House. Say what you will about Obama, and I do, but these Republican pigs, I mean, it's just astonishing. And, you know, cut, cut, slash, slash, that's the objective. As Krugman says, although you'd never know it listening to the Randers, the past year has actually been a pretty good test of the theory that slashing government spending actually creates jobs. The deficit obsession has blocked a much-needed second round of federal stimulus. And with stimulus spending, such as it was, fading out, we're experiencing de facto fiscal austerity. State and local governments in particular, faced with the loss of federal aid, have been sharply cutting many programs and have been laying off a lot of workers, mostly school teachers. And somehow the private sector hasn't responded to these layoffs by rejoicing at the sight of a shrinking government and embarking on a hiring spree. You notice that? You notice that, truth seeker? Or are you too far gone? Okay. Krugman goes on, okay, I know what the usual suspects will say, namely the fears of regulation and higher taxes are holding businesses back. But that's right-wing fantasy. Multiple surveys have shown that lack of demand, a lack that's being exacerbated by government cutbacks, a lack of demand is the overwhelming problem businesses face, with regulation and taxes barely even in the picture. For example, when McClatchy Newspapers recently canvassed a random selection of small business owners to find out what was hurting them, not a single one complained about regulation of his or her industry, and very few complained about much about taxes. And did I mention that profits after taxes as a share of national income are at record levels? The Republicans are lying sons of bitches, and the Democrats are cowards. So, Krugman says, short-run deficits aren't a problem. A lack of demand is. And spending cuts are making things worse, much worse. Maybe it's time to change course, huh, you think? Which brings me, Krugman writes, to Obama's planned speech on the economy. I find it useful to think in terms of three questions. What should we be doing to create jobs? What will Republicans in Congress agree to? And given that political reality, what should the president propose? Well, the answer to the first question is that we should have a lot of job-creating spending on the part of the federal government, largely in the form of much-needed spending to repair and upgrade the nation's infrastructure. But what will Republicans agree to? That's easy. Nothing. Nothing. They will oppose anything Obama proposes, even if it would clearly help the economy. Or maybe I should say, especially if it would help the economy, since high unemployment helps them politically. See what I mean? They are treasonous, traitorous bastards. What do you normally do with traitors? What do you do with them? Think for a minute. People commit treason. What happens to them? That's right. Krugman says this reality makes the third question, what the president should propose, hard to answer, since nothing he proposes will actually happen anytime soon. So I'm personally prepared to cut Mr. Obama a lot of slack on the specifics of his proposal, as long as it's big and bold. For what he mostly needs to do now is to change the conversation, to get Washington talking again about jobs and how the government can help create them. For the sake of the nation, especially for millions of unemployed Americans who see little prospect of finding another job, I hope he pulls it off. But Mr. Krugman, man that I deeply respect, you have it in point two. The Republicans are going to agree to nothing. Mr. Obama will give his speech Thursday night. And then absolutely nothing will happen. Nothing. Stick around, we'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. 7 past the hour. Woohoo! So what it would be like, what would it be like to have no postal service in the United States, right? You ever thought about that? Remember when you were a kid, if you're over a certain age, you remember when there were 2 mail deliveries a day. You know, in the cities. I don't know what it was like out in the country, but I grew up in a medium-sized city, Toledo, Ohio, and 2 mail deliveries a day. There was usually one around 10 o'clock in the morning, that was late, and then one around 4 in the afternoon. And they did that, I believe, 6 days a week. I don't know, maybe on Saturday it was only one delivery. And postal employees, of course, were looked at as real losers. Remember? Huh? That was the employer of last resort. You wanted to work for the post office? Ah! And in a sense, in a very real way, there was a trade-off. People who went to work for the post office knew that they were going in because of the rules written by the postal union and agreed to by the quasi, at the time, semi-government agency that ran the postal service. As a matter of fact, I think it was a government agency back in the day. But, yeah, we had a postmaster general. Do we still have? See, I don't know anymore. I really don't know. But anyway, the agreement was potential postal employees would enter into that semi-military world. Postmaster general, surgeon general. You know, there's a lot of militaristic attitudes in these organizations that are headed by somebody with the hyphenated general, trust me. So people would enter the postal authority knowing a couple of things. First of all, they'd have a job for life. You know, unless they turned out to be, you know, well, we'll get to that in a second. But they would have a job for life. And what they would give up is any chance of real advancement, real challenge. Like one might deal with in the private sector. Even in the public sector, there were ways to advance, but not in the post office. The post office is about job security. Now, that was really important because most Americans at the time wanted to make sure the mail was on time. You know, deliver the mail, right? This is not hard stuff, folks. This is really elementary stuff. You organize your society around certain principles. Like, first of all, you want to remove the waste you produce, either from your body or from living, as far from you as necessary. Well, that requires a system of getting it away from you. So we develop sewers. Going back to Roman times. I mean, probably before that, sewers. Get rid of all the garbage, the crap, the human waste. And we also want fresh water. So you develop a water system. We also want mail. You develop a postal service. These are just organizing principles that you use if you're going to set up a society. Now, if you want to live in huts and caves and straw houses dotted here and there and arm yourself, this is what Republicans want. Arm yourself because somebody may come over and try to, either molest your spouse or take your grain steal your children and sell them into slavery. So what do? You arm yourself and you stay isolated. Nobody mails anybody because there's, you know. Okay, that's getting ridiculous. My little analogy. But here we are. The Republicans now want to destroy the Postal Service. Remember, it wasn't so long ago that Rick Santorum and a few of these other right-wing freaks wanted to end the U.S. Weather Service? Remember that? And turn it all over to a private enterprise like the Weather Channel. Of course, the Weather Channel, you have to have cable to get it, but never mind. So Republicans continue to commit acts of treason against the United States. Now, is that treason? Jesus Christ, Malloy, treason! I'll get to that in a second. First of all, let me mention that this hour of the Malloy Show is being sponsored by Dean Poirier. Is that how you pronounce that? That's very French. Poirier? Poirier? Dean Poirier? I guess that would be it. Dean, thank you. I'm sorry for garbling your name. No message, just Dean is sponsoring this hour. Thank you, sir. destroying the post office has always been a goal of the right wing. And there are a couple of reasons. First of all, it is a huge, one of the biggest remaining reservoirs of unionized labor, the U.S. Postal Service Union. I think it's called that. And turning it all over, of course, to, UPS, FedEx, which are good companies, I guess, but, having a country, a society without a postal service is typical Republican insanity, madness. Their further efforts at destabilizing the society, and anyone who takes as much effort as Republicans do or devotes as much effort, time, and energy to destabilizing the society can only be seen as traitors, i.e. committing acts of treason against the United States. Definable acts of treason. Destabilizing this country is an act of treason. Whether it is flying airplanes into buildings, or trying to abolish the Postal Service, or ending Social Security, or destroying Medicare, or denying public health. These are acts of treason. These are acts committed by people dedicated to the idea of destroying the United States. What the hell do you call it? A walk in the park? It is treason. So now, the Postal Service. Yeah, I know. When you were a kid, it was 3 cents to buy a stamp. I know. Remember when penny postcards were penny postcards? Remember? It wasn't that long ago. Jesus God, there are a lot of us alive who remember that. Oh. The post office, though, has always been on the edge. It's always, what's going to happen to the post office? Oh, man, they got to raise the rates again. What? Jesus, it was just 12 cents. Now they're going up to 13? Jesus, it was just 15. Now they're going up to 17? Oh, my God, it was just 20. Now they're going up to 21. You know, you've watched this if you've been paying attention. Well, of course, a couple of things have happened. One of the most destructive to the post office has been email. Who in the hell writes letters anymore, right? Who writes for, unless you're being sued or investigated, who sends you a first-class letter? Okay, the private utilities. Remember when the utilities used to be public? Remember that? Yeah, you remember that? Oh, my God, that seems so million years ago, doesn't it? Jesus Christ, am I this old, or did this stuff happen this fast? There used to be one phone company. But I digress. The post office, according to New York Times, has never been as close to the precipice as it is today. The Postal Service is so low on cash, it will not be able to make a $5.5 billion payment due this month, and may have to, here it comes, it may have to shut down entirely this winter. Neither snow nor rain, nor barking dogs, nor dark of night shall stay these faithful couriers from their appointed rounds, or something like that. There used to be honor in the post office. Yeah, okay, so it was a job where you went to for job security and gave up any chance of clawing your way up some corporate ladder. By the same token, America needed you. Everybody knew. I mean, your mail carrier, we used to call him mailman, can't anymore. Your mail carrier? That person was a key part of your life. Are you kidding me? And now? Well, the U.S. Postal Service is depending on Congress to take emergency action to stabilize its finances. And you know what's going to happen there, don't you? More in a minute.
Thank you.
Day Screaming with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. So the post office, the postal service, U.S. Postal Service, is on the verge of crashing and burning. And they, that service is depending on Congress to take some kind of action to stabilize its finances. Well, then you know what's going to happen. First of all, people like Daryl Issa will come out and make statements that, you know, the Postal Service has been a reservoir of socialism in this country since Ben Franklin. Obama will give a speech and talk about how he really, really supports all the long-suffering workers in the Postal Service. And he understands why people, quote, go postal, end quote. And he will make sure he and his administration that somehow, some way, the work ethic of the people in the Postal Service will be honored and respected. Now, of course, all that from Obama means absolutely nothing. Zero. Issa is just a fascist son of a bitch like all Republicans in Congress and wants to destroy the country. They are committing treason. They are traitors. Every single Republican. In addition to everything else, in addition to being liars, cheats, sneaks, and bought and paid for whores, no offense to real sex workers, bought and paid for by capitalist America, not only that, but they are committing treason. Every single Republican in Congress. You disagree? Look up any definition of treason. But I digress. The Postmaster General said in an interview, quote, our situation is extremely serious. If Congress doesn't act, we will default, end quote. $5.5 billion payment due this month, and they don't have the money. Now, Patrick Donahoe is his name. He's the Postmaster General, so they still have a Postmaster General, of course. But, you know, back in the day, a Postmaster General was like, whoa, he's a Postmaster General. Now, I mean, who even knows about this guy? Which is a reflection of how disdainful we have become in this country about our public sector workers. I don't care if they're mail carriers. I realize it's not completely private sector. Don't start flashing me emails now about how it's a quasi independent agency. Rife with mismanagement. Don't. Public sector workers, whether they're firefighters or police officers or school teachers or postal workers, you know, are looked at now in this society by the right wing and by conservative Americans and by the Christians as in utter contempt. It's the new and fashionable thing to do. Oh, you're a public worker. Oh, for Christ's sake. We're going to get rid of you. Yes, you are. And in the process, you commit treason and display yourself in full flower as a traitor to the United States. Because here's another 250,000 jobs that the Republicans are just dying to destroy, get rid of. Yep, it's coming. In recent weeks, Donahoe, the Postmaster General, has been pushing for a series of cost-cutting measures to ease or erase the Postal Service's deficit. The deficit will reach $9 billion this fiscal year. Anyway, his cost-cutting measures include eliminating Saturday mail delivery, closing almost 4,000 postal locations, laying off 120,000 workers, nearly a fifth of the workforce, despite clauses in the union's contracts that say no layoffs. It's in there. Now, if 120,000 is a fifth, uh-oh, 600,000 workers. What did I say a second ago? 250,000? My bad. 600,000 workers that the Republicans want to dump into the unemployment lines. Why, of course they do. That way it'll be easier to convince people to work for $2.50 an hour. Decades of contractual promises made to unionized workers, including that no layoff clause. Those promises are increasing the post office's costs. Labor represents 80% of the Postal Service's expenses. labor. And that's because it's a labor-intensive business. Oh, my God. Take a look at it. That's not a robot that comes up to your door or drives by your mailbox. That's a walking human being. Those are not robots who are selling you stamps and getting your mail for you if you have a P.O. box and it comes registered or too big for the box, you know. Those are not robots, although sometimes you probably want to reach across the desk and have a serious discussion with them. You know, we all get that way about clerks. It doesn't make any difference who the clerks are. Of course, we, for the most part, are real asses when it comes to being customers, right? Especially with postal employees. Well, that's getting a little bit different now because we know that expression, going postal. We know that every postal worker has a fully automatic assault weapon just right behind the desk there. And if you mess up, they'll just pull it out and kill 40 people. We all know that, don't we?
Seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. If you want to see the post office disappear, it's about to. It really is. This hour is sponsored by Dean Poirier. Poirier? I'm attempting the French pronunciation here. Dean, thank you. I appreciate your sponsorship. Postal Service is on the verge. $5.5 billion payment due this month into their retirement fund and other stuff, I guess. I think it's probably more. This is an 80% labor-intensive agency. United States Parcel Service, their labor costs 53%. FedEx, 32%. Postal workers also receive more generous health benefits than most other federal employees. And it is very much in vogue right now to for the folks who are not a public employee to sit back on their asses and start screaming all kinds of slurs at firefighters, postal employees, teachers. And again, don't send me an email and tell me that postal employers are not really public employees. They're close enough, truth seeker. The Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee will hold a hearing. Thank God it's the Senate. On this agency's predicament, or did hold a hearing, I should say, today. I'm reading yesterday's, this article is in yesterday's New York Times. However, with Democrats and Republicans in Congress, one party, the Democrats, a bunch of pee-their-pants cowards, and the other party, the Republicans, utter an absolute. Traitors who should be put up on charges of treason. Oh, I know. You hear that all the time. I know. There is not going to be a solution to this. Thomas Carper, who is a Democrat from Delaware, said, he's also chairman of the Senate subcommittee that oversees the Postal Service. He said, quote, the situation is dire if we do nothing, if we don't react in a smart, appropriate way. I got that far in the sentence and started laughing my ass off. If we, the Senate, do not react in a smart and appropriate, see, there it comes again. I can't get past that part of the sentence. A smart and appropriate way. The Senate. Let me try one more time. If we don't react in a smart and appropriate way, made it. The Postal Service could literally close later this year, he says. That's not the kind of development we need to inject into a weak, uneven economic recovery, end quote, Thomas Carper, a Delaware Democrat. Uh-huh. Now, missing this $5.5 billion payment, which is due the end of this month, which is intended to finance postal employee retirees' future health care. It won't, if they miss the payment, that won't cause immediate disaster. But according to the New York Times, sometime early next year, the agency will run out of money to pay its employees to gas up its trucks to deliver the mail, forcing it to stop delivering the roughly 3 billion pieces of mail it handles every week. Boy, if it ain't piss ants, it's bed bugs, huh? Now the Postal Service. The Postal Service has had a tough time cutting its costs to match the revenue drop. And a lot of the revenue drop is because of email, electronic bill paying, and a web that makes everything from fashion catalogs to news instantly available. Now, I know a lot of people say, well, goddamn, I'm glad, man. All that crap I get in the mail. Well, you're right. All that crap you get in the mail is that third-class garbage. That is what helped pay for your first-class delivery 6 days a week. So now that it's done via computer, via the web, via the net, well, okay. You take the good with the bad, boobala. Anyway, because of that revenue drop, because people are just not using mail as much as they used to, whether it is first-class mail, who in the hell does that anymore? Or bulk mailing, third-class mail, all that stuff. Since there's been that revenue drop and this history of labor contracts that offer good health and pension benefits, imagine that. A labor contract that offers good health and pension benefits. Holy Christ, where are we in the Soviet Union? Good health and pension benefits? Well, that's communism. Oh, yeah, underused post offices and laws on the books that restrict the Postal Service's ability to make basic business decisions. You know what they are. Throw people off the workforce. Deny people the right to bargain collectively. Stomp the hell out of them. Now, a little bit of that goes on, just enough that people occasionally, it's in the vernacular, go postal. What does that mean, go postal? That means to pick up your fully automatic assault weapon that you keep in your locker in the back of the post office and open fire when you finally have had enough. Am I making light of tragic situations? No, I'm not. Okay, they don't keep them in their lockers in the back of the post office. They go home and get them. But anyway, the Postal Service cannot make decisions like reducing the frequency of deliveries. Now, one way to cut some of the costs, of course, this would mean cutting a lot of people, wouldn't it? Would be every other day delivery. Eliminate Saturdays. What's wrong with every other day delivery? I don't know. I have no idea. I don't work there. I don't make these decisions. But the alternative that it appears that we're facing here, it's kind of like rail service, passenger rail service in this country. We're a nation of 330 million people who desperately need rail service because of the vastness of this country. And Republicans have always tried to stop it because, you know, railway workers are usually unionized. We don't want that. Don't want those goddamn unions. And Democrats refuse to do anything when they're in power because Democrats are wet-your-pants cowards, right? And Mr. Brock-ha-ha president, he's not going to do anything. What's he going to do? He'll come out and give a speech. I and my administration, with his head up, his chin up, you know, with that, from the look from the old Soviet posters, I and my administration will continue to show deep respect to the American postal worker who since the time of Ben Franklin, blah, 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 blah. Are we going to rescue you? No, of course not. We don't rescue people in this administration. We just cut deals with the capitalists and the Republicans. which is what I am. But anyway, so nothing is going to be done. You know nothing is going to be done. So if you rely on, a lot of people rely on daily mail service as contact with the outer world, as a moment of social contact. The postman shows up, or the mail carrier, to be correct in terms of gender identification. The mail carrier shows up. And in some areas, believe it or not, this still happens. Trust me, I live in the semi-rural South. Occasionally, the person waiting for his or her mail delivery will stand out on the road at the mailbox, and when the man or woman comes by driving their own car with a little yellow flashing light on top, they will actually talk to each other. Can you believe that? Yeah, a postal carrier and a postal customer will actually take a minute or two. Now, we got to stop that crap. That's where part of the expense is going, right? Talking! And in small town or rural post offices, when people go in to buy stamps or check their P.O. box or whatever they do, there is social interaction there, too. Can't have that. Oh, my God. That's like a bunch of old men sitting around a pot-bellied stove in the general store with the cracker barrel over there and the pickle barrel over there talking. God, we can't have that. Aren't you people connected? Don't you have wireless out here? Where now is high-speed internet? Now, there's another way to solve this, of course. As the Times points out, in some countries, post offices double as banks. No, not that kind of bank. No, not the predatory, rapacious, filthy capitalist banks. No. Places where you deposit your money and you pay a service to write checks, or pay a fee. And if you put money in your savings account, you get a little interest, which kind of offsets the check, you know, whatever. So in a lot of countries, I've had friends come over from, especially from the old British Commonwealth countries, who want to go to the post office for the damnedest stuff. And I have to say, no, that's not what we do at the post office here. And the answer is usually, well, then why in the hell you call it the post office? It's not a post office. Banks, they sell insurance. Post offices in other countries, they sell cell phones. But you see, in the U.S., Postal Service is barred from doing any of that kind of stuff. So, what's the solution? I'll have that for you when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Sponsored by Dean Poirier. Thank you, Dean. And if I garbled pronunciation of your name, I do apologize. Postal Service. Relying on action by Congress. Not for funding. They're not looking for money. That's the irony here. They're just looking for the Congress to bend or eliminate some of the rules governing the Postal Service. Remember, it's not a public, a wholly identifiable public employee organization. It's semi, quasi, half and half kind of place, you know. And since it requires some congressional action, nothing is going to happen. Say goodbye to the U.S. Postal Service as you've known it all your life. Now, I know a lot of people, younger people, by younger people, what am I talking about? Under 25, maybe under 30? The post office is kind of superfluous, maybe a little bit necessary when you're looking for a card from Auntie so-and-so or Grandma so-and-so, but it's not really all that important. But to people over a certain age, or, you know, which would include the vast majority of people in this country, the U.S. Postal Service is, it is important. I mean, it serves a function. It does something. Among other things, believe it or not, in the days before and even in the days since, the mighty, massive new master of the human race, the internet, before and during, the reign of the internet, the Postal Service kept people in touch, kept people together. It was a connection, either direct or indirect. Yeah. I'm telling you, trust me on this. I'm not a social scientist. But you start eliminating, not you, but when a society starts eliminating those social, connections and interaction, trust me, Facebook does not equal the Postal Service. Neither does Twitter. It doesn't. Those may be little conveniences, little, hey, I'm going to tweet something. Yay! But it doesn't equal the Postal Service. You either get that or you don't. Anyway, so the Postal Service, here's a way to save it. Allow the Postal Service to do those things in this country that it does in other countries, like doubling as a bank. Maybe as a little insurance company, you know, term life. That's all. Just maybe something that simple. Term life insurance, huh? Selling cell phones, prepaid cell phone service. Why not? Huh? The Postal Service is considering ideas like those. It's also considering getting the right to deliver wine and beer. What? And that's illegal right now? Well, how do we get the... Oh, I shouldn't...
That comes from, like,
I guess...
You can FedEx.
You can FedEx or UPS wine and beer. Well, our listener who makes wine out in California, how have we been getting that? Is that... come
UPS?
Oh, okay. I thought maybe he or she was sending it to us through the mail. Ooh, would that be fun? Anyway, they want to have the right to deliver wine and beer. Or allow commercial advertisements on mail trucks and in post offices. Pretty soon, now those are revenue raising ideas, but you understand, of course, that pretty soon, they're going to try to get advertisements into your dreams. Schools, churches, advertising all over the place. Buy this, buy that, buy this, buy that. Wait a minute. I don't have any goddamn money. How am I supposed to buy it? I haven't worked for 19 months. Advertisements the idea of members of Congress wearing jackets that have the logos of the people who put them there, the advertising logos. That's an old one, kind of like NASCAR drivers. You've heard that before. That's been talked about for the past decade or so. But anyway, commercial advertisements on postal trucks and in post offices. Offering special hand delivery service for correspondence and transactions for which email is not considered secure enough. Now we're going back to the mid-19th century. You've seen those, only. You've seen the Merchant Ivory movie where someone shows up with a hand-delivered mail letter, right? You know. These are great ideas. Now, cutting the workforce would be a lot more difficult. The Postal Service's labor contracts have long guaranteed no layoffs to the vast majority of its workers. And management agreed to a new no layoff clause in a major union contract 3 months ago. So now, faced with the equivalent of a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, the Postal Service is asking Congress to enact legislation that would overturn all these job protections dirty semi-public workers, and lay off 120,000 workers, in addition to trimming 100,000 jobs through attrition. And the Postal Service is also asking Congress for permission to end Saturday delivery. Now, this may be something that the Republican murderous sons of bitches, the treasonous bastards who are in Congress, the Republicans, they may go along with, because the outcry and the shriek and the scream from Americans, once they found out that no more Saturday delivery and maybe mail delivery every other day, that scream would immediately be focused, because, you know, the Bachmans and the Perrys would make sure it would be focused on Barack Obama. See? He took away your mail delivery. So it just may happen. But if you're thinking about sending a snail mail missive to this program, do it soon. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.